Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so we've heard a lot today about problems that we face, and for the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about a possible solution. That's the idea. Let me start by asking you a question. Which part of a research study do you feel, as a scientist, should be beyond your control? Right. Hopefully we can control every other bit, right, of what we do, except that. Which part of a research study do you feel is most important for publishing in top journals and advancing your career? You know, we talk about incentives a lot. It's very easy, I think, for discussions about incentives in science to kind of reduce to some abstract idea of rewards and punishments and so on. But I actually think that illustrates the problem, the incentive problem in science, the most clearly. Two things that you're not supposed to control, one thing that you're not supposed to control, but two ways influences your career hugely. Now, when you have a results-driven culture, we know that it distorts the incentives in science, so that what's best for our community as a whole is publishing high-quality research regardless of the outcome, but what's best for me as an individual and all of you as individual researchers is producing a lot of good results. Results that are positive, novel, exciting, and so on. And I'm sure I don't need to reiterate a lot of this because you've heard it already. What I will say quickly, though, is perhaps to put some of this in the context of the scientific method. If you put researchers under pressure to get good results, this relentless publish or perish, this relentless pressure to produce results that are exciting and get into top journals, the community will produce those results. They'll do exactly as they're instructed to do, but they do it by circumventing the scientific method in various ways. Almost every stage of this process is vulnerable to various forms of distortion and self-deception. In psychology, we've documented, perhaps better than any other discipline, the rate at which these problems occur. I think Mark has probably talked about this in some detail, so I don't need to reiterate, except to say replication is very rare, power is low, various forms of p-hacking is common, parking or changing the hypothesis after analysing a set of data in order to predict something that in fact was surprising is very common because it helps us tell stories. Publication bias is very common and data sharing is rare. So at every point in this process, there is a vulnerability that when you place researchers in a culture that requires them to get good results, you expose those vulnerabilities. This is not unique to psychology, my discipline. I'm sure there are people here from a range of different fields. If you work in the life sciences, then this is an issue that probably your field faces as well. This report published by the Academy of Medical Sciences in 2015 highlights the broad range of scientific disciplines that have problems with reproducibility and transparency because of this results-led culture. So I recommend that report. So why is this happening? Well, as you probably guessed, it's because I think we place far too much emphasis on the results of experiments and studies that we do and far too little on the processes that produce those results. And that's because, fundamentally, this is human nature, right? So we're doing science because we want to produce results. Results are why we do science. If there were no results, we would be theorists. We wouldn't be empiricists. But the moment we start judging the quality of the science and the quality of the scientists themselves, your value as a scientist within your particular career structure, based on the results you produce, that's when we become soft science. If you ask a chemist or a physicist or an oceanographer why they think that the social sciences and some areas of the life sciences are unreliable, they will tell you this. They will tell you soft science. It's results-led. You're less interested in discovering what's true. You're more interested in telling stories to impress each other. Now, we can fix this, but it requires a fairly fundamental change in our mindset as researchers. It's a philosophical shift in the way we think about the research we do. And the philosophy, which you may agree or disagree with, goes as follows. When it comes to hypothesis testing in science, what gives our work its value is the importance of the question that is being asked. How badly do we really need to know the answer to this question? The robustness of the method that is used to answer that particular question, and never the result that is produced from a combination of those two things. The result should be irrelevant in assessing quality if these two conditions are met. Now, if you follow that logic through to its natural conclusion, you end up in a very interesting place. Think about how publishing works. We submit papers to journals with complete data sets, with complete discussions. Everything is included in one when we submit them. But in fact, if you follow this through to its natural logical conclusion, if results tell us nothing about the quality of the science we're doing, then there's no reason why results should factor into the editorial process of journals. And there's every reason why journals should be kept blind to results. If results can only bias me one way or the other as a journal editor or a reviewer, if they can only add that kind of bias and no informative value about quality, then there's no sense considering them as part of the editorial process. The editorial process, just like a properly controlled clinical trial, should be maintained blind to the intervention. The intervention in this case being results. And this is, it's from this philosophy that registered reports emerged. This idea that in order to eliminate once and for all various forms of bias and questionable practices in the life sciences and in the social sciences, we need to have results-blind review, or ideally, review before results even exist. And this is where registered reports came from. So we launched this first in 2013 at the journal Cortex, and there are four main elements to this. The first is that there's an initial stage of peer review that happens based on the hypotheses, the experimental procedures, and the analysis plans. This happens before the researchers start their data collection. And if you pass that initial stage of peer review, then the journal virtually guarantees to publish your paper regardless of the outcome. So there's no results yet at all. There are no results to consider at that initial peer review stage. The review is based on the importance of the question you're asking and the rigor of the method you're proposing. The way it works is authors submit a stage one manuscript, which contains this introduction and method and any proposed analyses and any pilot data if you need to validate an effect size estimate or if you need to perform any kind of proof of concept. This goes to stage one peer review, where reviewers are asked to answer a number of questions. Are the hypotheses well-founded? Do they stem from a strong theory or a strong application? Is there a good reason to want to answer this question? And are the predictions based upon the appropriate background context? Are the methods that they're proposing feasible and sufficiently detailed that somebody else, another researcher, could come in and repeat what the scientist is proposing to do without having to email them and find out all the other things they can put in their paper, without having to find the secret source, that kind of thing? Is there enough information in that method for it to be repeatable and reproducible? Is the study well-powered? We've heard about the problems with low power. So reviewers are asked to assess whether the sample size and the effect size estimations are sufficient in order to ensure high power. And crucially, have the authors considered sufficient positive controls or outcome-neutral quality checks that once the results are in, can confirm that they actually did a good job in running this experiment, that they ran it to a high standard. All of this happens before results exist or are known. So goes to these reviewers, they answer these questions. If the reviews come back positive, the journal issues what we call an in-principle acceptance, or IPA, regardless of the study outcome. And most of the time, the protocol is not published at this point, although researchers can self-publish it if they wish. They've got their in-principle acceptance. So now they go away and they do the research that they've had approved through the journal and through the review process. When they're finished, they come back with a full paper. It includes the introduction and the method from the stage one manuscript, and results, which is divided into two sections: the outcomes of all the pre-registered confirmatory analyses that they got through the review process and were approved, and any additional exploratory analyses that they wish to run also, because of course we want to preserve and protect exploration in science. There's no barrier to doing that in a registered report, it's just reported in a different section of the results. And of course there's a discussion, and as part of this initiative, data is also deposited in a public archive. This goes out to stage two peer review. Now, stage two peer review is different from stage one. All of the review of methodology has been done. All of the review of theoretical value and significance has been done. Now, stage two is quite simple. Did the authors do what they said they would? Are any deviations to protocol justified, reasonable, and are they transparently flagged? Did any positive control succeed? Are there any reality checks or quality checks in their data that needed to be passed, and were they passed? And other conclusions justified by the evidence. And if you pass those three, then you get published. None of these things have any impact on whether your paper gets accepted or not as a registered report. Statistical significance is irrelevant. Novelty is irrelevant. Subjective judgments about impact of results are irrelevant.
We get a whole really wide variety of papers,
just at Cortex alone, submitted as registered reports. Here are three examples. A MEG study, a multi-site replication study, an EEG study with Dorothy. Just to highlight for you the three key characteristics of this format that I think separate it from other forms of publishing. The first is the reproducibility. There's two ways these are more reproducible. The first is that they include very detailed method sections. They're not like normal method sections where there's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of knowledge gaps where you just don't know what the researchers did. These method sections are more comprehensive because they have to be repeatable by another scientist, independently and internally repeatable. And the other form of reproducibility stems from the sample size and the high power. So but when you set a threshold for power, you immediately find that sample sizes go up by a factor of 2 to 3. It's just a certainty. And as Richard says, they're probably not high enough. But I'm certain the registered reports we're getting in that are powered to 90%, even based on conservative estimates, are probably not conservative enough. There's an additional element here of transparency. So transparency happens in a number of ways. First of all, the open data and materials that are packaged with a registered report ensure that the community can analyze and reuse those data and those materials more easily. And there's a level of transparency in the way the results are reported. So you've distinguished between your confirmatory outcomes and your exploratory outcomes in a way that you simply will not find in a standard paper most of the time. And there's because of these things, you get extra credibility, I think, when you go down this route. So you know there's no publication bias. You know that in a sample of registered reports, because the decision to publish is made before results exist, it is, in my opinion, the only solution to publication bias that we have yet come up with. There's also no hindsight bias. I can't fool myself into thinking I predicted something that I didn't if my hypothesis is pre-registered. It's there to remind me, it's there to remind the reviewers. And I can't selectively report either the outcomes of my confirmatory analyses because, again, they're pre-registered. So the current state, I'll give you an overview of where we are at with this initiative. So it began back in 2013 with one journal. There are now 75 journals. 59 of them have adopted this permanently across a wide range of fields. So we've got neuroscience, everything from neuroscience through to clinical and preclinical medicine. We've got social sciences picking up on this really interestingly. So political science is very interested in this, various areas of economics and accounting research. And even the physical sciences, the more robust end of science, in my view, they're also interested in this because one of the things that's interesting about publication bias is that it is ubiquitous. Every field has some trouble publishing some kinds of results. And because this format eliminates that entirely, it's attractive to some areas of the physical sciences. If you want to see some published examples of registered reports, you can go to the Zotero database that we've created where you can find around 70 fully completed so far. Just to highlight a few journals of note that have launched this, so Royal Society Open Science is one, it's a generalist journal that offers them across 200 different fields from really every STEM subject. Nature Human Behavior, which is an interesting choice, I think, because it busts this myth that this kind of format will only be suitable for, you know, like low-impact journals or specialist journals. And it's also interesting for another reason. I don't know how many people here are from humanities or social sciences, but this is an outlet that will publish, you know, registered reports in anthropology or cultural studies. So it's an outlet where you can get there's a much broader potential impact. Registered reports at BMC Medicine. This one I wanted to flag because it's the first registered reports model for clinical trials that we've seen. Now, you might think clinical trials, why do you need this? Clinical trials are more robust and registered and everything. But in fact, there's a lot of problems with hidden outcome switching and selective reporting in clinical trials and non-reporting of clinical trials that get negative results. So this format has a lot of traction even in the clinical trials area, which is a hell of a lot more robust than most of the work in other fields. And I think it actually raises a very interesting question. When you apply the registered reports model to clinical trials, it's very difficult to escape the conclusion that all clinical trials should be published this way, exclusively. We can say in basic science, you know, that there's a place for exploratory research without pre-registration. But if in clinical trials, there's really no place for purely exploratory research. It's all, by definition, confirmatory. And if our aim is to produce a balanced clinical evidence base, it's very difficult, I think, to avoid the conclusion that all trials should be registered reports.
There's a curated list of these that you can find at the Centre for Open Science. As I said, there's 75 journals there so far, and that's getting updated all the time. Another one that may be of interest to this audience is BMC Biology, which is the first kind of wet lab and also like hardcore biological journal that's offered this. So I'll just address very two frequently asked questions, and I'm sure you've got others, but I'll just these ones initially. You might be wondering if these are really suitable for my field, and I think they are, provided your field does any kind of hypothesis testing, so it's not just doing purely exploratory research where you're mining large data sets for patterns, but you're actually testing predictions arising from theory, and where any of these problems apply. If any of these problems apply, then this format can have a benefit in that field. It's also quite suitable for fields where you might be thinking, well, I do a lot of experiments in sequences. You know, I just don't do one big experiment and then publish it. I might want to do one and then do another and do another and do another. And a registered report is also very suitable for that. So you can pursue what we call an incremental registration, where you publish the first part of your registered report with completion, and then you add pre-registered protocols kind of onto them as you go. So you can go through a review process that allows that. And you can also submit registered reports where you propose a sequence of experiments from the beginning, if you have some idea of where you're heading. Now, the registered reports format isn't suitable for purely exploratory science. It isn't designed for science where you don't really know what you're predicting, you don't really know what your question is, but you're kind of poking around and trying to generate predictions or hypotheses. It's designed where there is hypothesis testing. And for that reason, it's maybe less relevant for certain kinds of methods development as well. You might be wondering, well, is this a threat to exploratory research? If we create a place where, which really champions this confirmatory hypothesis-driven science, are we somehow challenging the value of exploratory science? And I get this question, this argument raised quite a lot. And I would very much argue strongly in the negative that there are no restrictions in a registered report on exploratory analysis. The only requirement is that they are reported separately from confirmatory analysis. And in fact, we can zoom out from this a little bit more and say, well, how much truly exploratory science do we see published in the journals? When's the last time you picked up a copy of Nature and saw someone just report something they saw in a life sciences area or a social sciences area even, without there being some kind of prediction in the paper? And this is because, at the moment, I believe, we've got into a situation where exploratory research just isn't valued for what it is. And so if I do an exploratory study and I get a certain outcome, I feel a lot of pressure to create a story around that in which I predict what I found. And that means we need to create, at the same time that we create a place for purely confirmatory research in publishing, I think we need to be thinking about ways of celebrating exploration in its native form also. And that's why at Cortex we're about to launch the kind of the opposite of registered reports, called exploratory reports, where it's really just about literally exploring a data set without any great hypotheses, without any real emphasis on inferential statistics. It's really just about describing what you've seen in that data and what it might mean and where you might go next. Just to go a little bit further before I finish, at the moment, registered reports are something that has really existed solely within journals. But you might be thinking there's a similarity between a stage one registered report, a protocol, and a grant application. Often a grant application is something that happens at a different scale. They're often in a very, there's just different levels of granularity in them. But you could ask, well, could we potentially integrate those two processes? Could we basically create a stage one registered report that goes to a funding agency, you get your money, and then you get your paper accepted at the same time? There's no reason this isn't possible. And this is precisely the basis of the registered reports funding model. So under this model, researchers submit a stage one registered report or a series of stage one registered reports to a funder. It is then reviewed simultaneously by a particular journal and the funder. And if both parties agree about the quality of the proposal, and there is a process that enables revision, similar to like you would get with peer review for a journal, then you get two things on the same day. You get your funding awarded and you get your paper accepted or your papers accepted at the same time. This can help streamline the whole review process. Rather than having multiple stages of review for grants and papers, we can just do it all in one go. So it's arguably a lot more efficient and also a lot more transparent.
So at the moment, the status of this is that we have a number of interested journals and publishers, and we have a number of interested funders. And Marcus, who I think is left, but he's really pioneered this with the journal Nicotine and Tobacco Research, which he's the chief editor of. And he's partnered up with Pfizer and with Cancer Research UK. They were the first two schemes that have launched this. And just yesterday, very exciting news that PLOS One have teamed up with the Children's Tumour Foundation to create the second working model of this. You may have seen this announcement yesterday. So the idea here is that under this drug discovery initiative that CTF has, researchers will submit their grant proposal to CTF, where it will be simultaneously reviewed by the funder and by PLOS One. And the highest quality proposals will have their in-principle acceptance given at the same time that they get their grant awarded. So it eliminates publication bias and it maximises efficiency. If you want to find out more about this, you can pop along to the Registered Reports page, which is at this URL here, cos.io/rr. There's all kinds of material on here that I haven't got time to go into today. We've got an extensive frequently asked questions section because there are a lot of... This is quite a fundamental kind of shift in the way we think about peer review and publishing. So people often have a lot of questions about that. You can find most of the answers there. And I think it's quite important, too, to emphasize that there's a table and we've created on this website, which compares the features of different journals. So if you're considering submitting to a particular journal, it will tell you what specific policy features that journal offers. So for example, does it offer registered reports for data that already exists, and all you want to do is pre-register an analysis plan? Does it require open data, etc., etc.? And I'll finish by just saying that you can also contact me anytime if you've got any questions, because I'm the chair of the committee at the Centre for Open Science that oversees this, or David Mellor, who's the Registered Report Manager. So thanks for your time.